Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Jackson, Mississippi in the 1980s. Kiese Lehman is a little kid excited for summer to start.
The first day of all the summer camps, you had to go get a physical, you know, to make sure you were fit enough to be in summer camp.
As part of his examination, he had to step on a scale.
And the doctor wrote on my little form a word that I couldn't understand. And I was like a big reader. My mother made me read all the time. And I was like, what does this word mean? And it looked like O-B-I-S.
He tried to convince himself this word meant something good.
Like super strong or something, but I had no proof that that's what it meant. And then I remember these other twins who looked at my form and they were like, man, that says obese, bro. Like, that's not, that doesn't mean strong. that means really fat. I'm laughing about it now, but at the time it was really sad.
Our bodies are ours, but how we feel about them is so often defined by others. The things people say, by the society and culture we live in, what kind of body is acceptable or not.
You look weak.
Ooh, that sweater looks kind of tight.
You look like skin and bones.
You're so disgusting.
You're not strong enough to be with the adults.
You're not looking too good. Are you sick?
On today's episode, the outside forces that shape how we feel about our bodies. Let's keep going with Kiese Lehman's story. He teaches creative writing at the University of Mississippi, and he has a new book. It's called Heavy. It explores Kiese's relationship with his mother, a brilliant and complicated intellectual who pushed him to excel in school, and it explores his relationship with his body, his weight, which fluctuated a lot over the years, from being obese to scary skinny. When you look at yourself in the mirror now, at your body, what do you see?
Oh, wow. You're starting kind of hard, huh? I see two things. I see a old dude, and I also still see like a young boy. You know, my body went through a lot of different changes. So when I look in mirrors now, I tend to try to just focus on my eyes.
As a kid, Kiese was tall for his age and heavy. He was athletic, loved to play sports, but he was always aware how others perceived his body.
I wanted to try to make people understand that even though I was bigger than most people, like, I wasn't trying to hurt anybody. I wasn't trying to harm anybody. So it made me just really conscious of, like the fear sometimes you could see in people because of the size of my body. And again, it's not just the size. I think it's also that I was, like, a big black boy. And, you know, 11 and 12, people are treating me sort of like I'm a man, you know, because I was pretty big. I looked like a man. Until you came up on me and you saw that. I mean, if you looked at me in the face, you could see I was a boy. But it just meant being treated like a man in places when I actually really just wanted to be treated like a child.
In one of the chapters in Heavy, Kiese describes how his weight totally spiraled out of control during his first semester in college. His mother was doing a postdoc at Harvard at the time, and then they both got home for break.
When you came home for your Christmas break, you looked at me, shook your head, and asked, what are you doing to yourself? You made me get on the scale in front of you. 256, 264, 269, 272, 275, 287, 296. I asked you to leave and then took off my clothes and tiptoed on the scale again. 293. In one semester, 3.5 months, I gained over 50 pounds.
What do you think was happening with you when you were in college? It seemed like eating was compulsory at that moment.
I mean, college is hard for everybody, but I had just never been around that kind of wealth. I never had to go to sleep and wake up around like lots and lots and lots and lots of white people before. My teachers, for the first time in my life, kind of talked down to me, like treated me like I wasn't smart enough. And so I would go to Waffle House, and then right after Waffle House, I'd go to Dunkin' Donuts. Right after Dunkin' Donuts, I'd go to Taco Bell. Or at the time, it was just like food and eating way too much was the only way, one of the only things I could control. And I just felt full, you know, like in this weird way, like I just needed to feel heavy because I felt so light in other parts of my life. So I think that's what I was doing. Control, not just my body, but my position in the world.
You and your mother talked about weight quite a bit. And
yes,
it seemed to me that the weight sort of became a stand-in. That was something you could talk about, but you were really talking about, like, how are you doing?
Right. Yeah, the weight conversation was definitely a proxy for, you know, the conversations we should have been having about emotionality, about trauma, about our memories, about our fears. And so in absence of that, you know, we could talk about, you know, Key, are you cutting down on your carbs? And my mama would be like, I feel like I lost a little weight today, or I feel like I'm gaining weight today. Or sometimes I really do think we talk about weight when we're afraid or unable to talk about things that might matter more.
After college, Kiese got his first teaching job at Vassar, a liberal arts college in Poughkeepsie, New York. And there, he started to diet obsessively and exercise. He lost a ton of weight. I asked him to read another chapter from Heavy.
The fourth day of my seventh semester at Vassar, I bought a used stair stepper from the gym. After three more hours of basketball and an hour of jogging, I maxed the heat in my tiny apartment and stair-stepped until I was down to 165.7 pounds, 60 pounds less than I weighed at 12 years old, and 153.3 pounds less than I weighed at my heaviest. The heaviest version of me was past tense. My current body was present tense. There was no limit to how light I could be, and I knew I needed to live in the future.
I'm wondering if you can elaborate more on the issue of race and how that fits into there's a bigger American conversation or obsession with body and shape, and then race comes into that conversation, gender comes into that conversation. But I'm wondering if you can put your finger on how race fits into this for you.
It's interesting. Like, I don't think there's a clear answer, because when I was at my smallest, I think people definitely treated me like I was less obtrusive in space, but I'd have people still describe me to somebody else as like that big black guy. And I was like not a big black guy at that point. You know, I mean, I was the same height I am. Maybe that's what they meant. But I think blackness, and particularly black masculinity, is seen as like something that is potentially like not just space taking up, but also like potentially harmful. And that has something to do with the size of my body, but it has also to do with the way like blackness and black boy bodies and black men bodies, I think, have been treated in this country, and definitely where I'm from in Mississippi.
And I was wondering if there's the aspect of feeling unwanted, criticized in some communities where people made you feel like you didn't belong or questioned whether you belonged. I was wondering how that feeling was internalized into your body and made you either want to take up more space or less space.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. The thing about Vassar that's interesting is that Vassar's, you know, it's seen as being a really elite intellectual space. And when I first got my job at Vassar, I was shocked at how small everybody's bodies were. I was like, man, they're just not a lot of big people. And they're definitely not a lot of fat people. And they're not people who walk with limps. And the people who are bigger and the people who do walk with limps happen to work for the college and building the grounds or the cafeteria.
Kiese says writing this book has helped him work on his relationship with his body, to learn to accept it. And he says he understands some of his compulsory habits now. I have one last question I have to ask you. Have you stopped weighing yourself?
Yes. Yes, I definitely have stopped doing that. Because the problem with me is, like, once I start weighing myself, I'm not going to stop, right? Like, the next day I'm going to try to, I'm going to try to go do something to try to make that number lower, like, in an hour. and then I'm gonna try to make that number lower in an hour. Like, I don't know. I can't weigh myself and be healthy. And all I wanted to do actually was just disappear. Like, I just wanted the number to get as low as I could, which ultimately means, like, I wanted to disappear. And so I'm glad I don't want to disappear anymore. Really glad.
Kiese Lehman's new book is called Heavy. He teaches creative writing and English at the University of Mississippi. We're talking about our bodies, how we feel about them, and the messages we get from others. As we age, our bodies change. We might slow down a little bit, maybe arthritis creeps in. Age affects what we can do and also whether others think we're attractive. Here's a take on that experience.
I've never been afraid of getting old. I was afraid of being helpless. I'm 72. My name is Ernie Young. That's short for Ernestine, but no one calls me Ernestine. I wanted to be that sharp, spry old lady. When I hit my early 60s, I went on this physical fitness trick and got down to my fighting weight. I used to go around and say I had Michelle Obama arms. I was working out at the gym 3-4 mornings a week before going to work. I did spin classes. I was walking for sometimes 8 miles a day. Some friends and I were vacationing in Santorini, and we were getting ready to go to the beach. And I'm sitting there looking between two bathing suits, trying to figure out which one made me look better. And then suddenly I start laughing. I mean, at that particular point, I was like 65 years old. And I'm going, at 65, nobody will care which one of these suits makes me look better. You become invisible at 60. You know, you do become, to a certain extent, invisible. As a woman, it is a sort of attractiveness. Who are you being attractive for? Because most men your age are dating women 20 years younger than you. So you're not going to get their attention. No one flirts with you anymore. You're in a bar and you're getting a drink. No guy is going to offer to buy you a drink. I don't care how good you look. And that comes as a shock as you get older. If I have wrinkles, I earned them. I don't worry about that anymore. I worry about feeling comfortable in my own skin. Even at the point when I say I want to lose 30 pounds, that 30 pounds is not to make myself sexy. That 30 pounds is to make me comfortable in my skin, to make my body work better for me.
That's Ernie Young. She lives in Philadelphia. We're talking about bodies, how we feel about our body, how much of that is shaped by where we grow up and live, by what other people think and say. Our next story is about a man, Robert, who says that because he's HIV positive, others started to view his body as dangerous. And in the state where Robert lives, his body was considered basically a weapon in a crime, which landed him in prison for almost a decade. Reporter Zach Dyer visited him to hear this story.
After spending 9 years in prison, I would have thought the last thing he would want around would be reminders of that time. But sitting here in Robert's small efficiency apartment is a token of the worst time in his life.
Yeah, have you meant to actually have it out for you. It's sitting over there.
He points out a sweatshirt.
Just a sweatshirt to anyone else, but that's my name and my inmate number on the back of it. I like to do little things that remind me.
Wait, why? Why would you want to keep that for yourself?
To remind me how I'm seen.
Robert asked us only to use his first name to protect his privacy. He faced a lot of hostility because of his HIV status, especially when he was first diagnosed back in 1998. Someone even threw rocks at him.
And kicking my motorcycle over when I parked it on campus, you just start to realize that it's never going to be okay.
By 2006, Robert was living in Kansas, and in that state, lawmakers considered his body a weapon.
It says reckless risk of infection with HIV while knowingly infected with HIV.
Robert was convicted of exposing his sex partners to HIV. No one contracted HIV because of him. But according to the law, that doesn't matter. In Kansas and more than 30 other states, it's a felony if an HIV-positive person has sex with someone and fails to disclose their status. Robert says the law that sent him to prison effectively makes his body a crime.
I actually wound up getting a tattoo.
Can I ask you what the tattoo is?
Mine is red, which is the symbol for political prisoners. There's a bar above it with my with HIV plus in it.
When Robert was convicted, he was in treatment, on medication, and his viral load was undetectable. If you're living with HIV, this is what you want. It means the treatment is so effective that tests can't find significant amounts of virus in the blood. The virus doesn't completely disappear from the body, but immune systems recover and symptoms fall away. And in the early 2000s, studies started to come out with exciting findings, showing that people with undetectable levels of HIV were not spreading the disease to their sexual partners. Robert had been following the news about these studies. His viral load had been undetectable for years. He didn't see himself as a danger to anyone.
As far as I was concerned, you know, the science was clear.
Robert says he was confident he wasn't a risk to anyone. So he dated and had sex without telling people he had HIV.
Were you using condoms in those relationships or no?
Yes and no. As I wasn't choosing to. You know, as I wasn't saying, hey, stop, we have to. It was just, if they wanted, yes, if not, no. I knew I was not a danger.
Prosecutors in Kansas did not agree. Robert's decision not to disclose his HIV status became known in his community. And ultimately, he was arrested, convicted, and spent nearly a decade in prison.
If someone is undetectable, that is irrelevant under the current version of the statute.
That's Tim Lomar. He's the prosecuting attorney for St. Charles County, Missouri.
Just talks about exposure without disclosure. Doesn't have anything to do with the likelihood of contraction or whether it's scientifically nearly impossible for them to contract the disease.
Tim wasn't involved in Robert's case, but he's prosecuted similar cases. Tim says when he speaks with victims, they say the news that they've been exposed to HIV is life-altering.
You can see the, you know, the devastation, and you can hear the devastation in your voice. You can hear the fear. You can hear the nervousness as to whether or not life as they know it is going to be forever different.
Tim has a duty to prosecute these cases, but he says the laws, as they're written, are too rigid. His office tends to recommend lighter sentences or punishments.
You know, I don't think that somebody who recklessly exposes someone to HIV should necessarily serve 10 years in prison. I don't think that's the answer.
Critics around the country, including the Justice Department, say these laws are outdated and not medically accurate. Worse yet, these laws may have perverse unintended consequences. For example, Tim Lomar points out that in Missouri, it's actually better not to know your HIV status. The law that sent Robert to prison, it only applies to people who know they're infected with HIV.
So if you take that argument a few steps forward, that might discourage people from getting diagnosed.
Tim says prosecutors like him are bound by laws written 30 years ago. And as the science changes, it may be time for lawmakers to re-examine these laws. The science has grown stronger that HIV patients with undetectable viral loads don't transmit the virus through sex. There's even an awareness campaign to promote the findings.
So excited to keep putting this word out there and making sure that people really understand what U equals U means.
The message is undetectable equals untransmittable. U equals U. Neurologist David Clifford from Washington University in St. Louis has been working with HIV patients since the 1980s.
What has changed recently that makes this U equals U story a more comfortable thing to talk about is that there have been large studies.
Three large studies, in fact, all tracking patients with undetectable viral loads over years to see if they would transmit the virus to their sexual partners. Over something like 70,000 encounters were logged. Not one person in the study contracted the virus.
Zero out of 74,000. That's getting to be remarkable odds of safety.
In 2017, the Centers for Disease Control acknowledged that someone under treatment for HIV who is undetectable has effectively no risk of sexually transmitting the virus. Robert, the guy who went to prison for 9 years, feels vindicated.
Look, it's this simple. Undetectable equals untransmittable. Therefore, if a person knows their status, takes their meds, gets their checkups, they are not a danger.
But that growing awareness, even the validation from the CDC, has been little help to Robert since he got out of prison. He served his sentence, but he can never quite get away from how the state viewed his body. He has struggled to find housing and work since he got out.
I couldn't even get a pizza delivery job. I mean, it was bad.
When he applied for jobs, his criminal record revealed his HIV status to prospective employers.
And it was many, many, many interviews of, oh, wow, you're great. You have all this knowledge and you're so well-spoken and you're so well-dressed. We can't wait to. And then I go back to cold face, barely wanting to shake my hand when I stick it right in front of him.
And that time in prison did more than just hurt his job prospects. It changed him.
I used to be fairly gregarious. I didn't meet a stranger, as the saying goes, and then this definitely flipped that because I stopped being able to trust that people would give me a fair shot.
Robert says he's been hurt by people's reaction to his body, hurt by the way the law sees HIV as a weapon to be wielded and not a disease to be treated. And he says he understands that fear, but
that doesn't mean I consider myself a criminal or deliberately trying to harm anyone. And I don't think these laws helped in any way. What did taking 9 years of my life do? I did what I did because I believed I was harmless.
That story was reported by Zach Dyer. We spend so much time, energy, and money trying to improve our looks, and the cosmetic surgery market is booming in the U.S. Women account for the vast majority of that business, but new research shows men are increasingly getting in on the action as well. Many are focusing on their body's calling card, the face. Liz Tung looked into this.
So let me start off by saying that I do not buy into the whole stereotype of women being overly concerned about their looks. But the fact remains, if you grew up as a girl in this country, and lots of other countries for that matter, you have been bombarded by the message that your looks matter, that they shape how people see you, how they treat you. And if you don't believe me, just look at YouTube.
Today I'm going to show you how to do some plastic surgery just using makeup.
This video is about how to make small eyes look larger.
On how to make your eyes look bigger.
I naturally have quite a wide nose, and when I smile it gets even wider.
That's just a sampling of the thousands of online makeup tutorials devoted to fixing flawed faces. It's a daily ritual for a lot of women. But what about men? Do they feel any of the same pressures to improve their looks? We did an informal poll of men that started with the question, if you could change anything about your face, what would it be?
And my face?
About my face?
Wow.
I ain't bothered by my looks at all, man.
I don't really... Yeah, I wouldn't say it's something I like or dislike about it.
I never gave it that much thought. Holds my glasses up.
That's right. Most of the guys we talked to said they just don't think about their faces. So it's maybe no surprise that when we asked whether they'd consider plastic surgery, they said things like,
probably not.
Nah, I wouldn't.
No, I wouldn't change anything.
Unless you had a dramatic injury that defaced your face.
God brought me here like this, I'm gonna go out like this.
So who are the guys driving up plastic surgery statistics who actually get their faces done? To find out, I visited a plastic surgeon named Brannon Clater.
Hey, Liz.
Hey.
Clater, how you doing?
Well, come on in here and drop
Thanks.
Off here.
Brannon runs his own practice in Media, Pennsylvania. It's a well-heeled suburb near Philadelphia.
I can be injecting Botox in here. It's a very comfortable chair.
And he says he's definitely noticed growing interest among men.
This trend has been going on for more than 4 years. And it's just growing.
Brannon says about 15 to 20% of his patients these days are male.
They are fathers, they are business owners, they are successful professionals. Somebody that is very comfortable with themselves, but feels that there's this one little area they'd like to just tweak. Certainly, one of the leading procedures we do is facelifts.
He says a lot of male patients also come in to get rid of double chins, otherwise known as turkey waddles, and for blepharoplasties, a procedure that lifts droopy eyelids.
And it can really make you look like you've just had your best night's sleep.
Brandon says he's not sure what's driving this growth in men getting plastic surgery. There aren't any studies on it yet, at least none that we could find, but he has a few ideas. And his number one suspect? Smartphones.
Effectively, people are walking around with a mirror at arm's length all the time.
A mirror that can take pictures and post them instantly to social media.
There are many, many more photographs being taken and shared immediately. Patients will come in and say, I hate being in these photographs because my neck looks so bad.
So think about it. As a guy, you may have gone from literally never thinking about your droopy eyelids or saggy neck to suddenly having it shoved in your face all the time. Another big reason Brandon thinks more men are getting cosmetic procedures done is that people are living longer, which means they need to work longer too.
They are not ready for retirement, but people are starting to ask them and say, you know, when are you retiring? And so they come to us saying, you know, I really want to be able to project that youthful persona.
So what do Brandon's patients say about their reasons for going under the knife? I decided to ask one, Bill Strohauer. He's a weight loss physician.
Weight loss and weight control. We see the cheaters, you know. Angels and martyrs don't need to be here.
As you can probably tell, Bill is kind of a quirky guy. He's thin with glasses, cleft chin, and strawberry blonde hair. But a couple years ago, when Bill looked in the mirror, he didn't see any of that. Instead, he saw this.
This is your turkey neck, I guess, and, I couldn't get rid of it.
Bill was about to turn 70 and feeling depressed.
Yeah, it's even hard to say the age.
For him, getting older means the end of things.
There's nothing really to expect. You usually end up checking the obituary pages. That's about it.
So Bill decided to take some measures. He started by taking dance classes.
I don't know. I said, teach me to dance like the Antonio Banderas, the tango, that. And Patrick Swayze in Dirty Dancing, The Last Dance. I like that, too.
And ahead of his birthday, he decided to cheer himself up with a facelift.
I figured, I have to look in the mirror every morning. And if it's going to make me happier and more motivated to do things, then I will.
A year and a half later, his face still looks pretty good. Relatively smooth and no flabby skin hanging under his chin. But when I ask if he's satisfied, Bill says,
I guess. I don't know. Things starting to come back? Am I losing weight? What's going on?
The other thing Bill worried about, at least at the time, was what people would think.
Just worried about people thinking I was crazy. Guys don't do that, blah, blah, blah.
Remember, Bill is 70. He grew up in the era of rugged, tough guys. Men who didn't talk about their feelings, much less what they looked like. Guys with a stiff upper lip. Guys like...
Man ought to do what he thinks is best.
John Wayne, be tough and rugged. Who cares what you look like?
That's Fred Fettick. He's a former president of the American Academy of Facial Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery, and someone who's thought a lot about the factors that encourage and discourage men from getting plastic surgery.
There has been a stigma where men are socialized differently. Men are, I think, more private about their looks.
But Fred says that may be changing. Men may be starting to feel a bit more comfortable being uncomfortable about the way they look. For The Pulse, I'm Liz Tung.
We're talking about our bodies, how we feel about this body we have and what other people say about it. Shane Duquette was always skinny, really skinny. As a kid, that wasn't such a big deal, but the taller he got, the more people said he looked weak or unhealthy. At 6'2", he weighed just about 130 pounds.
My biceps were the size of my wrists. Basically, my thighs were the size of my ankles. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I looked sort of like a stick bug, like a greyhound. I was doing martial arts, and they would say, like, I'm sorry, Shane, you're not strong enough to be with the adults. You need to go in the beginner group, and we need to pair you with the girls, because we're worried that you're going to get hurt if you spar with the other men. So that was humiliating for me at the time.
Eventually, Shane came up with a new way of eating, calorie dense but still healthy, and he found ways to work out that added muscle to his skinny frame.
I used to feel like just my body was there to carry my head around. I had learned to accept that I was a head person, not a body person. And then learning how to gain weight and gain strength, it allowed me to feel joy when doing physical activity. So it really changed my entire life.
Shane Duquette started a website for skinny men looking to gain weight. It's called Bony to Beastly. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about bodies and what shapes our sense of self. A serious illness can really impact how you feel about your body. It can give you some appreciation of all the things a healthy body does, or it can leave you feeling like your body is broken. Filmmaker Emily McKenzie is interested in the ways breast cancer changes people. Hey, Emily.
Hi, Maiken.
And Emily, you've been working for a couple of years on a documentary about people's experience with breast cancer. It's called Tapestries. What do you want to get to with your stories?
I was interested in how breast cancer affected people's sense of identity. In my reporting, I found voices that don't really fit so neatly into the pink box that breast cancer stories often come packaged in. And today, I want to share with you two stories, two very different people, but they both have had double mastectomies and have gone through a process of struggling to understand their bodies and be at home in their bodies. So I'd like to start with Shay Sharp from Baltimore.
As a woman, you're supposed to have breasts. I'm supposed to have those.
Shay was 26 when she learned she had to get a double mastectomy.
I did immediate reconstruction. Once they took the breasts, we put in tissue expanders to prepare to get implants.
Shay didn't really think much about the decision. It was a pretty common surgery, and it seemed like there was little risk.
You know, they mentioned possibly being numb at the incision site, but never thinking that the entire breast is becoming, you know, going to become numb. Oh yeah, we're going to rebuild these breasts, but you're not going to be able to feel anything.
After that initial reconstruction, her body rejected one of the implants, and Shay had her surgeons replace it. A year later, it happened again.
So we took both implants out at that time.
Cancer had already made Shay feel less sexy, less desirable.
So you're wondering, like, is somebody still going to see me as normal with all of this, you know, cancer baggage, you know? I felt like I needed that. You know, I needed to feel as womanly as possible, even with these ailments. I still wanted to be desirable, you know, from the guys I were dating or whoever I was going to be intimate with, whoever I was going to end up with.
After two rejections, Shay still wanted breasts, but her body couldn't take the silicone implants. So her doctors offered an alternative, a surgery in which they created breasts using tissue and fat from her abdomen. The surgery was complicated, and the recovery was going to be brutal. She'd be out of commission for weeks. But still, she decided to do it, her third reconstruction. And it was a success, for a time. After a few years, the cancer came back, and she was facing a possible fourth reconstruction. Shay says at that point, everything began to shift in her mind.
How many times am I going to have to go through this? How much more scarring can my body take? How much more skin do I even have for reconstruction? I'm tired. I don't want any more surgeries. I don't want any more cuts. I don't want my body cut on anymore.
Shay was convinced. Her boyfriend at the time wasn't. He felt uncomfortable with the idea of her having no breasts. And she says that when she was honest with herself, she understood where he was coming from.
I almost really can't be 100% mad at him because he's trying to do to me what I had actually done to myself all these years, trying to make that representation of looking like a woman make me look complete. I was like, wait a minute, did he just do to me what I was doing to myself all these years?
That was really the turning point for Shay.
It took a while, but I made this decision and I was okay with it. So once I became okay with Shay, like, it didn't matter whether I had boobs, no boobs, I'm fine with it. I like it. I don't need a bra. It feels nice. You know, I'm still 100% woman, and this is me. This is it. Take it or leave it.
Emily, Shay sounds relieved.
Yeah, Shay was really able to embrace her new reality, her new body. And in fact, at this point, she now has a wonderful nonprofit called Shay Sharp's Pink Wishes. And they do sort of special wishes for young breast cancer patients. So she's become a mentor and a role model for a lot of people facing breast cancer.
Who else did you want us to meet? Who else did you meet in your journey talking to all these different people?
We're going to hear from Eli, who wants to remain private and not use a last name. Eli lives in Oakland and, like Shay, was very young at diagnosis, only 33. Eli identifies as trans non-binary and uses they-them pronouns. Eli's relationship with their chest had always been a struggle.
So I'm kind of like in the mirror, like really kind of just trying to get my breasts out of the way so I can kind of like imagine what I'm going to look like with a flat chest. And that's how I found this lump that was really kind of wedged in there under my armpit.
As Eli navigated cancer treatment and the medical world, Eli says their gender identity as a non-binary person was mistaken or ignored at every turn.
I would just say, don't call me ma'am, I'm trans. And I'd be saying it over and over again to the same people. Mm-hmm. It was like adding like a 100-pound weight that I had to carry around on my body in addition to the normal kind of efforts that you make and like processes that you have to go through just to like get diagnosed and deal with breast cancer. It's a lot.
As exhausting as cancer was, with it came some unexpected options.
For me, I felt like this is a hell of a way to transition. The whole way through, I was like, what the f***? I started going to a support group for folks outside the gender binary, and I was like, oh, this is where I belong. And that was when I started to feel like maybe I have permission after all to actually embrace that I feel uncomfortable having breasts, to actually go after the fact that I've thought about top surgery for a long time. Top surgery is different than a double mastectomy. Like double mastectomy, they just take out the breast tissue. Top surgery, they give you a male appearing chest. Like I'm not super interested in being male appearing or having a male appearing chest. Like I just wanted a flat chest. I just didn't want breasts. Breast cancer has been part of my transition, but the transition is not like a traditional narrative. Ultimately, like what I got was a really gender-affirming surgery. That's what happened for me.
So how is Eli doing now? Are they happy with this decision?
Yeah, I think what ended up happening was a surgery that made Eli feel at home in their body.
That's filmmaker Emily McKenzie. She's working on a documentary about breast cancer, and we'll put a link to her website on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. So many of us spend a lot of time and energy trying to change our body, make it smaller, bigger, somehow more acceptable. Jennifer Kriatsoulis struggled for years with her body. She had anorexia.
When I was in the throes of the eating disorder, you know, the biggest thought that always came through was one of disgust, you know, just disgusting. Even as I'm talking about this, I can feel my face contorting, you know, just saying that word, disgusting. You're so disgusting. That was like the umbrella term. Well, here's the thing about eating disorders. They're not really about the weight. They represent so much more than that. They're a way of coping with trauma, pain, distress, discomfort, feelings that don't want to be felt. So for me, even though it was manifesting in this, you know, losing weight, there really was no end to that, right? Because what really needed to happen was inner healing around different things that have taken place in my life. You know, focusing on the weight was just one way to not have to focus on all of that. Thank God for the people in my life who helped me, supported me, because who knows if I'd still be here.
Jennifer is a yoga therapist now. This is not a downward dog warrior pose kind of yoga class that you would take in your neighborhood gym. This is a very specific approach to therapy. It incorporates breathing, yoga poses, meditation. Here's Jennifer talking to one of her clients who is also in recovery from an eating disorder. And this client often feels a lot of pressure in her life.
And what does pressure feel like to you? Where do you feel that in your body? What are some of the thoughts and messages that are coming through when you are encountering that pressure to do more?
Well, the message is that whatever I'm doing is not good enough. Mm-hmm. And I feel it in my body. I feel clenching in my throat, mm-hmm. like I want to scream. Mm-hmm. I feel tightness in my chest.
Right. So if you were to reflect a little bit, when you're feeling this pressure, are you breathing?
No, not at all.
So what would it feel like right now to just, you know, honor what you've shared, compassion for the fact that this pressure shows up, and to give yourself a couple good breaths right now?
I can do that.
Okay.
Jennifer says yoga can be such a healing force, connecting people to their bodies in a positive way. But she says so often it's taught with a focus on getting skinny and toned, like this will flatten your belly and this will get rid of the jiggle in your arms, that kind of stuff. So she wants yoga teachers to be mindful of the language they use in their classes, talking about what bodies can do rather than what they look like.
You know, like I think about, say, planks. Sure, they are strength building, but they're also teaching us perseverance. You know, our balancing poses, yeah, they teach us how to breathe through challenges. And people are starting to notice their bodies in new ways. And that's where the change happens, right? When it's not about my belly's this, instead it's like, oh, I notice a sensation in my right leg when I do that. Wow, that's pretty cool. I never noticed that before.
Jennifer Kriatsoulis has a new book. It's called Body Mindful Yoga. You're listening to The Pulse. Aaron Ball had been a circus performer for a decade, climbing up strips of fabric hung from the ceiling, doing drops like the acrobats of Cirque du Soleil. But then, several years ago, she was lost in the woods for days. She got severe frostbite, and she became a double amputee. For months after the surgery, she thought her life and the work she loved was over. But eventually, she learned to walk and even perform again in her new body. We visited Erin in her wheelchair-accessible studio in Kingston, Ontario.
If your hand is down, if you have a hand, open it up, spread it.
These days, she teaches circus classes to people with all kinds of bodies, but that's something she couldn't even imagine before her own body changed so dramatically.
So I was found by a police dog. I was unconscious. A few days later, I woke up very confused in the hospital. I do kind of remember at one point hearing something about we're not going to show her feet yet. And when they did, they were unrecognizable, purple and bloated and starting to fall off themselves. I didn't know any amputees, and so I just thought that my circus career was over. You know, I just felt like I couldn't get out of bed anymore. There was like just no reason to live. I really feel like there needs to be some place where people are allowed to actually heal and grieve and do what they need to do. It's a pretty big deal. I lost both of my legs after having them, lower legs, after having them my whole life. And here I am in a wheelchair. I asked somebody to help me die. You know, I just couldn't understand how my life had done this. Huge flip, and I was brought back to the hospital. And I was in basically a catatonic state for months after that. The thought that I remember, I think it was just, I can always die later if I need to. And that's when I decided to start moving. I decided to learn to walk again with prosthetic legs. So I started trying to do like partner acro with other patients.
And then can all of you on the ground look forward?
basically stacking people, like human pyramids, the airplane position that parents and kids do.
Yeah, can you lift outside arm? And don't stick your butt out so much. Like, yeah. Stay engaged.
I spoke to a friend who had a fitness studio up many flights of stairs, and I, you know, really wasn't proficient at walking at that point. It took me so long, and it was so painful, and it was so hard. Stairs are hard. But I got there, and I was like, at the top. You know, I didn't know what I'd be able to do. I had been laying in a hospital bed for basically a year, but I had silks up, tied knots on my feet. The movements were in my body, but like my body had changed so much. So it was kind of familiar and foreign at the same time. Oh my gosh, how am I gonna do this with these feet? And also like, oh yeah, this is me. Like, this is my place.
Can you tell me if you're spotting that? Spotting.
It's exactly.
Yeah, definitely.
The first set of legs that I had were basically like red sticks. I just struggled so much every time I looked down, and it was like, I just want like a normal shaped leg, but no, here are these red sticks. I was trying to cover my legs with leg warmers, and I would shove a whole bunch of pairs in there, and it still looked really ridiculous. It was very obvious that I had the skinniest ankles. You know, my stepmother saw how upset I was, and so she put Pringles cans on there and duct taped them on, and then I put the leg warmers over that, and away I went. I was doing a performance, and my dad had come to see me, and in between sets, he encouraged me to take off the leg warmers, and I panicked, and I really wasn't sure that I was ready to be stared at all the time. I said to myself, okay, well, I'll just try it. And I took them off and I never put them back on. That was one of the biggest turning points. When I really started to accept my situation, I started going to the dollar store and just started thinking about, like, what random objects can I attach to my legs today? Confetti cans are always a big hit. I find that audiences really appreciate any things that I attach to my legs. Colored smoke grenades, zombie legs. Well, one thing that I can do now that I couldn't do before, just take my legs off at the end of the day. It is honestly the most satisfying thing. It's like taking a bra off, only like times 1,000.
Your foot fell off.
Something happened and I moved through it and I figured out how to make it work. And I still am constantly figuring out how to make things work. I thought everything was over. Like, it hadn't even begun.
That's circus performer Erin Ball. She spoke with audio producer Susie Armitage. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Julian Harris is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is the associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. Tanya English is the editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.